fearless anthropologist and community activist who made her way from Slovenia to Aho. Slovenia! Her partner, Sterling Johnson, was born and raised on the nearby Tohono O'odham Reservation. They are expanding and managing the main gardens, planting agricultural crops, and utilizing practices from the Indian reservation. Sejovic described Aho's food bank distribution experience to me as well. Just that week, at the First Assembly of God Church, more than 120 cars lined up to receive bags of food. This week's offerings included potatoes, broccoli heads, 3 or 4 loaves of white bread, some hamburger or hot dog buns, lots of citrus, and some sodas. Food bank workers passed the bags in through the car door windows. "It works better that way," said Sejovic, "because the experience is more anonymous for the recipients, who sometimes feel awkward." I asked about the recipients. "Largely the working poor," Sejovic told me, "ranging from young women in their late 20s with 3 kids to older folks who come dressed in their Sunday best, including one woman who always shows up in a beautiful fancy hat and wearing lots of makeup." And there's more. Aho students work in the edible Aho schoolyard garden, and some of their crops make their way to the school cafeteria. Cannon told me that by 2016, obesity rates had dropped up to 11% among classes of the K-6 students, who are the ones participating in the program. At the end of our final visit to Aho, we saved time for a mad dash through the plaza's Saturday morning market. We bought several loaves of still-warm bread that we'd watched rising in the kitchen of one of the Aho artists in residence the evening before. We bought jars of local citrus marmalade and regretted passing on the flowers, which we knew wouldn't travel well. Some of the market produce had come full circle from the gardens at the elementary school to the market stands where the kids' parents shopped for it. There are nearly 450 students in Aho schools, which span pre-K through 12th grade, including the 37 seniors who graduated in May 2017. The high school, which opened in 1956, and the elementary school, which opened 35 years later, are located in a series of low-slung, single-story buildings. Each classroom has a doorway to the outside walkways, protected by overhangs should it ever rain here in the desert. The classrooms seemed dark to me, perhaps as protection against the desert heat and sun during most months of the school year. It's not a highly privileged school population. According to the Aho School District, about 84% of the students in Aho qualify for free or reduced lunch. Some 67% of the students are Hispanic, about 17% are white, and another 10% are Native American, a population that fluctuates from year to year, as some students move back and forth between Aho and the Indian schools on the reservation. Kids land in Aho with a variety of stories. Some come with parents looking for jobs. One girl's single mom worked with the border patrol. One boy's dad had piled the family in the car and was driving south through Arizona looking for work. In Aho, a tire went flat. With no place to purchase a new one, they scoured the yard sales until they finally found a used one. They went on their way again, and a few miles out got another flat. At that point, the boy recounted, his father realized that a tire shop could be a going business. So he turned the family car around, drove back to Aho, and opened a tire shop, which is still in business several years later. Others have spent their whole lives so far in Aho. One girl, a sweet and confident sophomore, described her household this way. "Mom works in an office. Dad, not sure. Grandma makes tortillas. Grandpa is disabled." Then, when I asked what she did when she wasn't in school, she dropped what to me was the bombshell. She takes care of her own 1-year-old son. So far, it's working. She has a 4.0 grade average and is aiming for the University of Arizona. "How can it be working?" I asked. "I'm good at multitasking," she answered, as though it was just that simple. I shouldn't have doubted her abilities. In 2017, I heard that she had graduated and was heading to college. Aho's schools are fighting economic and cultural headwinds, but their recent progress has been impressive. Aho High School's four-year graduation rate has grown from 50% in 2003 to 79% in 2010 to 92% in 2017. In 2011, not a single Aho senior applied to a four-year college. Among the class of 2017, about half the students who graduated are heading to college. The superintendent of the Aho Unified School District, Bob Dooley, told me that Aho High School grads are starting to return from college with positive reports to give their high school friends. The kids who go to college are making it there now, Dooley said. And this is a big change from recent times, when the reaction to the challenges of college life used to be, "What do you expect? You're from Aho. You're wasting your time." Lauren Carrier, the principal, says it takes time to build the college-going culture. Families are excited when the kids are admitted, but they can turn reticent when the reality hits that their teens would actually be leaving home. We heard about that reticence in other heavily Hispanic communities around the Southwest, where family ties run strong and deep. Sometimes, Carrier says, the family will uproot and follow the student child all the way to Phoenix. Like other small towns, Aho needs to keep the professionally trained, skilled up, and higher educated grads. The employment options in Aho make that hard now, although every new restaurant or studio or service that opens in town is a promise of change. The school wants to nurture more students who can make those changes for themselves in the town. Can someone open a vet clinic? Can someone be a lawyer? Can they make an entrepreneurial spirit? Carrier wondered aloud. We couldn't leave Aho without sharing the story of Isabella Selms Ferguson Greenway King. You just know that with a string of last names that long, the woman must have had an interesting life. I first learned about Isabella in Aho, where nearly a century ago, she joined her second husband, copper mining magnate John Greenway, to help develop the small company town. I ran across her again on a return visit to Eastport, Maine, about as far away from Aho as you could be in the continental United States, and across the water from Campobello Island, where Isabella visited her lifelong fast friend Eleanor Roosevelt. Finally, I traced her steps a third time near the end of our journey in Tucson, where she had embraced the West and its people by envisioning and building the renowned Arizona Inn. The headlines of Isabella Greenway's life with intentional adjectives: a rocky, disrupted childhood, unlikely opportunity as a newly privileged young woman traveling on the edges of early 20th century political and social power, drama and loss twice as a young widow of swashbuckling, pedigreed men, fearless engagement as an entrepreneur and a businesswoman, the first woman elected to the House of Representatives from Arizona. This is all documented in a wonderful 2004 biography, Isabella Greenway, by Christy Miller. Isabella's parents suffered hard times ranching in the turn-of-the-century Dakotas. Her beloved mother, Patty, struggled with depression and alcoholism. Her dashing but impractical father, Tilden Selms, died when Isabella was 9 years old. Isabella bounced, often solo, among relatives in Kentucky and Minnesota. Improbably, Isabella's father was friendly with Teddy Roosevelt in the Dakota ranch country, a happenstance that marked Isabella's later life. When Isabella was about 15, her mother moved them to New York, where they lived with generous relatives. Isabella attended fancy schools and met Eleanor Roosevelt. They were quick and sympathetic friends. The two spirited young women were favorites of Uncle Teddy Roosevelt and spent time in Roosevelt circles from Manhattan to the White House to the Roosevelt Sagamore Hill estate. Eleanor chose Isabella as a bridesmaid, one of only two who weren't officially family, at her 1905 wedding to Franklin. Shortly after that, 19-year-old Isabella married another family insider, Robert Monroe Ferguson, who had been a brave and dashing rough rider with Teddy Roosevelt at San Juan Hill. At 38, Monroe Ferguson was twice her age. San Juan Hill came back to haunt Ferguson in the form of tuberculosis, Just a few years after they married, he and Isabella moved with their two small children to New Mexico for the dry, healthy air. They domesticated a remote mountaintop homestead, living in tents and homeschooling the children. Isabella became politically active in the World War I efforts, chairing the Women's Land Army and toiling with other women in the fields while the men went to war. When Monroe Ferguson's health further declined, they moved to Santa Barbara, where he died soon after. Eleanor and Isabella always maintained a personal letter-writing relationship. It would ultimately last for nearly 50 years. They shared personal intimacies, including their sympathies for frequent losses, anguishes, and betrayals that punctuated their lives. Isabella had lost two husbands by the time she was 40. Franklin's polio and his affairs are well known. There were illnesses, the loss of parents, friends, children. Christy Miller and Robert H. McGinnis documented these letters in the book they edited called A Volume of Friendship, The Letters of Eleanor Roosevelt and Isabella Greenway, 1904 to 1953. In 1923, Isabella married John Greenway, a friend of and fellow Rough Rider with her first husband, and moved to Ajo. In 1926, John Greenway died suddenly in New York following a routine surgery, and Isabella returned to Ajo by train, suffering a miscarriage en route. 3,000 people attended his funeral. After John Greenway died, Isabella lobbied hard to place a statue of him in the National Statuary Hall in the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. It was a statue sculpted by Gutzon Borglum, who had carved Mount Rushmore. In 1928, Isabella was elected to the Democratic National Committee. 4 years later, she was rewarded for her effective lobbying on FDR's behalf with a chance to second his nomination at the Democratic National Convention. In 1933, Arizona's sole seat in the House of Representatives became vacant, and Isabella was elected to the seat with 73% of the vote. As a politician, she was loyal to her causes and her state, working for disabled veterans, the copper industry, and the underemployed. She won WPA projects for Arizona. And yet, in 1940, having voluntarily left Congress while still popular, she publicly supported Wendell Willkie over FDR, who was making his third-term bid. Isabella was equally fearless as a businesswoman. In the late 1920s, she started a furniture business called the Arizona Hut to employ disabled veterans. A few years later, she opened the Arizona Inn as a way to use much of that furniture. She bought and operated a cattle ranch. She bought a small freight and passenger airline called Gilpin Airlines. Back in Washington, D.C., on a break from our travels in the winter of 2015, I hoped to see John Greenway's statue in the Capitol for myself. Poor timing. I missed it by weeks. It had just been replaced with a statue of Barry Goldwater. In 1953, Isabella had died at the Arizona Inn, where we were lucky enough to stay during our last night of our final cross-country flight. San Bernardino, California. We flew across central Arizona into Southern California, and then through the Banning Pass toward San Bernardino. The aerial view over the desert and snaking through the mountains was beautiful. We could look down on Palm Desert, Palm Springs, and recognize the towns the way you would the streets in your neighborhood. It felt like home. The San Bernardino Airport was another signal to me that we were home. It was right next to Redlands, where we stayed several times during these 4 years of flying. We had watched the airport change and ultimately grow, from its demise after the closing of Norton Air Force Base, into a small, elegant FBO and a bustling repair center, where old hulls of giant 747s are rehabilitated. The aircraft were painted with names that took your mind to far-off destinations. Names like Eva, Uniworld, Arabiana, Meridiana.
San Bernardino is probably the hardest-pressed town in California. one of a handful of most troubled cities in the United States. Its problems are economic, political, historical, and those of simple bad luck. How many other cities have suffered an economic setback because an existing interstate highway was moved someplace else? That happened to San Bernardino in the 1970s before a lot else would go wrong. Of all the U.S. cities and counties that went into bankruptcy after the real estate and financial crash of the late 2000s, San Bernardino took the longest to emerge. A federal bankruptcy judge began considering the city's plan for regularizing its finances only in 2015, long after fiscal recovery plans for cities like Detroit and Stockton had been enacted and those cities had moved out of bankruptcy. San Bernardino's voters ratified the related necessary measures in the fall of 2016. I've had some idea of San Bernardino's situation for almost as long as I can remember. My hometown of Redlands is San Bernardino's immediate neighbor, the place where many officers from San Bernardino's huge Norton Air Force Base, professors at its community college and Cal State campus, and doctors at its hospitals chose to live. Redlands had its small, locally owned shops. San Bernardino had the big malls and national stores. San Bernardino had the McDonald Brothers' original Golden Arches hamburger store, which Ray Kroc took over and extended to a globe-girdling brand. That first McDonald's was only 3 blocks away on E Street from the campus of San Bernardino High School, home of the Cardinals. As visitors from Redlands High, we often went to McDonald's after tennis matches or speech tournaments or just on outings to the bigger city. San Bernardino was one of the stops mentioned in the song Route 66, composed just after World War II. Improbably, the very first performance the Rolling Stones ever made in the United States was at Swing Auditorium, right on the Orange Show grounds in 1964. And one of the most daring things I did as a generally rules-abiding teenager was to sneak out and see their show. But San Bernardino was also a Hell's Angels haven and the locale of frequent gambling and prostitution busts, plus gang violence outbreaks, and generally a tough town. People outside the state often imagine the Big Divide in California as something like the old Mason-Dixon line, separating its territory into North versus South. That is, the Bay Area of the North versus the Southland. The tech industry versus the industry. Redwoods versus palm trees. Stanford and UC Berkeley versus USC and UCLA. The more important dividing line more or less parallels the Coast Range of mountains and separates the state into west versus east, coast versus interior. On the western coastal side are the biggest cities, the most famous companies and universities, the richest people, and most of the national mindshare of what California means, including its concentration of Democratic voters. On California's eastern inland side are all of its deserts, most of its farmland, and a disproportionate share of its problems, from pollution to poverty to the worst consequences of the past decade's sustained drought. In political terms, this is also where most of its Republican districts can be found. San Bernardino County is the center of the Inland Empire of Southern California, the non-Los Angeles part of the Southland, essentially the flyover country of the state. Something I'm allowed to say because that's where I'm from. The county is the biggest one in the United States, although most of its expanse is Mojave Desert, and most of its people are packed into its southwestern corner, closest to its border with Los Angeles County. San Bernardino County used to include what is now Riverside County, which peeled itself off as a separate entity in the 1890s. San Bernardino was first settled in the early 1800s, became a major Mormon settlement in the 1850s, until Brigham Young called the group back to Utah before the Civil War, and through most of the 1900s developed as a big railroad and trucking center. Even when prospering, it was a no-frills, no-nonsense, bungalows with small yards, blue-collar place. Just after it had been named an All-American City in 1977, San Bernardino lost, one after another, everything that had allowed it to maintain its blue-collar job base. From World War II through all the Cold War years, Norton Air Force Base was where thousands of airmen and officers were assigned. When I was growing up a few miles away, enormous bombers and transport planes on the approach to Norton would pass over our schoolyards all day long. Teachers would routinely pause during class to wait for sonic booms from the jets to subside. Through the 1980s, the base had supported well over 10,000 local jobs. As part of the post-Cold War base-closing movement, Norton was deemed unnecessary in 1988 and shuttered by 1994. Norton's closing, plus the demise of Kaiser Steel in nearby Fontana, and the transfer of a major Santa Fe Railroad maintenance yard back to Kansas, ripped a part of the heart out of the San Bernardino area economy, as the local economist John Husing told the San Bernardino Sun. And really, he added, in many respects, the bankruptcy of San Bernardino today can be traced back to events in that period of time. The city's population had long been more majority-minority than the entire state's. San Bernardino is now about 60% Hispanic versus about 40% for California, and significantly poorer. The median household income in the city is under $40,000, versus over $60,000 for the state and over $50,000 for the country. San Bernardino is the poorest city of more than village size in California. When things went wrong for the country as a whole in 2008, they went worse for San Bernardino. Because its population was so poor to begin with, and had lost so many previous sources of income, the debt levels on its real estate shot up during the subprime bubble of the mid-2000s, and then home values fell extra hard, making the city one of the foreclosure centers of the country. Its unemployment rate neared 20% at the worst, and even as it improved, it remained nearly twice the national level. In 2014, a WalletHub ranking put it dead last on a ranking of job prospects in 150 metro areas. As if all of this were not enough, San Bernardino was also home to a uniquely dysfunctional city governance system. The city is an unusual metropolitan parallel to the modern zero-sum gridlock of national politics that keeps the nation as a whole from matching attention and resources to serious challenges. In most of the country, you don't see this trickle down to the municipal level. Sadly, for San Bernardino, national dysfunction has been matched on the local level. Some cities we've seen run on the strong mayor principle. Others have strong city managers. San Bernardino's unique and flawed charter gives it a strong nobody system of government. In theory, both an elected mayor and an appointed city manager had substantial authority to make decisions and address the city's problems. In reality, several interest groups within the city, most importantly the police and firefighters unions, had effective veto power over any decision they did not like. The odd structure had no real counterpart elsewhere in the country, and analysts had long pointed out its defects and its consequences in depressing a sense of civic engagement and possibility. Back in 1981, a visiting panel from the American Institute of Architects said, "There is an almost tangible absence of consensus among the residents of San Bernardino about the sense of identity and unity of purpose, the spirit of the community at large." The most important single result of its distorted system was clearest in the obscure-sounding but profoundly significant Section 186 system of determining pay for the city's police and fire services. No elected or appointed official in San Bernardino had any direct control over pay for public safety workers, namely police officers and firefighters. Instead, salaries were set by a formula that, in effect, tied San Bernardino's pay levels to those of much richer cities across the state, for instance, Irvine and Santa Clarita, each of which had a per capita income more than twice as high as San Bernardino's. A team of researchers from George Mason University calculated that the per capita income of the cities San Bernardino was being indexed to was just over $62,000, whereas the income in San Bernardino itself was around $35,000. Expenses in this category have made up more than 70% of the city's entire spending. But under the city's operating rules set down in the City of San Bernardino Charter, its officials were flatly forbidden to adjust, renegotiate, or trim the pay levels, even as they scrambled to cut costs elsewhere. The state's poorest taxpayers were locked into paying some of the highest salaries for their public servants. This city, with a per capita income of $35,000, ended up paying its public safety workers total compensation of about $160,000 apiece, or about $40,000 more than the statewide average. In 2014, there was a ballot measure to change this provision and to set salaries by collective bargaining, as they are elsewhere in the state. The police and fire unions, whose members are not required to live in the city and generally don't, fought back hard to block the measure and won. 2 years later, after court approval of the bankruptcy plan, which involved changes to the police officers' and firefighters' pay system, and large-scale efforts by the San Bernardino Sun and civic leaders to explain the situation, and structural changes, including a shift of firefighting responsibility from the city's control to the county's, a charter reform passed. This Measure L, which gives city leaders more control over salaries and finances, passed by a margin of 60% to 40%. The biggest hole through which the civic ship of state was taking on water had been patched. This is the beginning of a new day for the city, one that a lot of people worked very hard for. Phil Savage, head of a civic committee that drafted the revised charter, said that evening, according to Ryan Hagen of the San Bernardino Sun, "This city can now become what it used to be and what it should be." Could it actually become those things, what it was, what it should be? Here are the stories of a few teachers, civic activists, and neighborhood organizers already working to bring the city back. I start with Mike Gallo and Bill Clark, two friends who have committed themselves to changing educational and job prospects for the city's young people. By the time of our visit, when he was in his late 50s, Mike Gallo had become one of the wealthiest and most prominent citizens of San Bernardino. He is a stocky man with a mustache and a brush haircut. Gallo first came to town in 1980 as a young second lieutenant at Norton Air Force Base. He left the military in the mid-1980s to work with Dan Golden, later renowned as the longest-serving head of NASA, on a program to develop missile launch vehicles at the TRW aerospace firm. This was during the Reagan administration's Strategic Defense Initiative buildup, known as the Star Wars program, when the Pentagon was funding a wide variety of missile-related programs. In 1992, Golden left TRW to lead NASA. Without him, TRW reduced its emphasis on the launch business. And in 1993, Gallo, who was in his mid-30s, decided to do something different. He and some associates started their own firm. It was called Kelly Space and Technology, or KST, and its goal was to be a pioneer in the reusable launch vehicle business for military and civilian customers. KST became a bona fide technical and business success. It is still in the launch vehicle business, along with a variety of other advanced tech fields. It is still privately held and run by Gallo, and it operates in what are now the civilian facilities of the former Norton Air Force Base. The company's story suggests the kind of person Mike Gallo is. military and defense-minded, trained as an engineer, and schooled in modern management practices, so that his conversation is peppered with references to the latest Harvard Business School report and motivational comments like, "When you don't have a shared vision, you end up confusing activity with accomplishment. Because you haven't defined or, worse, prioritized your interest in investments, years later you end up just waking up tired without any accomplishments." Gallo talks passionately and very quickly. In addition to calling to mind other civic leaders we'd met, like Chris Gardner of Eastport and Joe Max Higgins of the Golden Triangle, he also reminded me of some of the most forceful entrepreneurs I've come to know. These are people who built their business not on clever apps or software concepts, but on tangible pieces of complex real-world equipment that have to be designed elegantly, manufactured precisely, and then sold and maintained one by one with real-world life and death consequences if they fail. I didn't ask Gallo about either his national-level politics or his faith, but from the posters and photos in his office and the general vibe, I feel safe in assuming that he is an active church member who votes Republican. This speculation interests me because the mission that now engages Mike Gallo is creating better, fairer educational opportunities for the mainly poor, mainly Latino or African American, mainly left behind students in his adopted city's public school system, and helping build a local economy that can employ them. Early in his time at KST, Gallo recognized that he was trying to build a high-tech company in an area with a low-skilled workforce. He became a founding member, and then the chairman, of the California Space Education and Workforce Institute, one of a list of regional betterment efforts he became part of, including a role at the request of Democratic Governor Jerry Brown to serve on the state's Workforce Investment Board. "I figure, why participate if you're not going to lead?" he responded when I asked him why he did all this. "I don't just sit around. I don't sleep much. That's what I do. I do stuff." Most of our modern economic utility models have a hard time accounting for people who decide to commit so much of their attention, effort, and peace of mind to public good causes of this sort. Gallo's involvement is based on his belief in what is called servant leadership, a doctrine about the duty to serve that has Christian scriptural roots. This led Gallo to become more directly involved in local politics. He won a seat on the 7-member San Bernardino City School Board in 2011. At his first meeting, he was elected the board's vice president. Not long afterwards, he became president. He came up for re-election to a 4-year school board term in 2015 and had no concerted opposition. Why did he bother to run in the first place, given the nightmare of school politics and the many other obligations he had? I figure you've got to get inside if you really hope to change the situation. And what did he hope to change? We have one of the poorest communities in the nation, 54% of the population on some kind of public assistance. And our public school system is requiring that our taxpayers further invest dollars that they don't have for students just to barely get an entrance requirement for community college. That's tragic. I couldn't take that anymore. You've got to fix it. Long before Gallo joined the school board, he'd set up a nonprofit organization, technically a 501c3, called Technical Employment Training, whose purpose is to train San Bernardino area students for better opportunities there or elsewhere. The San Bernardino drama is at surface level an economic story, but it is really a cultural and political one. It's a story of disengagement and suspicion, no one group feeling responsible for the others or willing to extend any bond of trust. That is what Mike Gallo said he most wanted to change. "We want to give our kids an incentive to stay here in the local region rather than continuing the flight of our educated population somewhere else. We have to create that sense of hope here and opportunity and trust." But why, again, here, with so much stacked so badly against him? When San Bernardino is a place he came to for work, not his original or generations-long home? And when almost any other city government, school system, or student-parent population would start out far ahead in rankings? Why is this worthwhile here? He thought for a moment and answered, "Why here? I am here. My kids are here. Now my grandchildren. You want to leave a place better off than when you found it. This is my place." There it was again, the comments about the hometown. From Sioux Falls to Eastport to Columbus to San Bernardino, hometown was home. Bill Clark grew up in boomer-era Southern California in a non-college family. "My dad told me that I had to get a degree and that I should get a job I really loved," Clark related when I met him. "I was fortunate enough to do both." From the mid-1970s through the late 1980s, he worked for General Dynamics in Pomona as a manager and trainer in their advanced automation divisions. In the late 1980s, while beginning work on a doctorate in educational management, he switched to the staff of the local community college, San Bernardino Valley College, where he headed the training departments for advanced manufacturing and welding. And through all those years, 1974 through 2008, he spent the mornings teaching manufacturing skills courses at Fontana High School. These were the years when, with some ups and downs, Southern California was still generally booming, and the skills Clark taught prepared students for higher-wage factory and construction jobs. But also during those years, vocational education and trade schools were falling out of public fashion because of the conceit that white-collar positions automatically meant brighter prospects and better pay. Why a conceit? The past decade has brought a reminder that skilled technical positions in maintenance and repair of advanced machinery, in healthcare fields and other laboratory work, in agriculture and food technology, in logistics and construction, are the era's fastest-growing good jobs. By 2010, San Bernardino Valley College had decided to phase out the machine shop Clark had been running, and he was ready to retire from his teaching role there. By that time, he had become friends with Mike Gallo. "Mike said, 'Why don't you bring your equipment over to my place and teach here?' Clark told me. I said, 'I don't want to teach anymore.' And then he said, 'Well, what if we started your own school?'" The result was Technical Employment Training, TET, a nonprofit trade school for adults that now operates in the building at the former Norton Air Force Base. Gallo became its CEO and Clark its president. Their ambition was to train the city's unemployed adults for middle-wage jobs available in the area's hospitals, warehouses, factories, and construction sites. The nonprofit aspect of TET is important. When I spoke with Gallo, he inveighed against some for-profit trade schools as representing the worst in the student debt syndrome. They deserved more blame, he said, because they loaded debt onto mainly disadvantaged students without carefully matching them to available jobs. And Gallo and Clark both emphasized the four-part strategy on which their TET approach was based. First, what they call a comprehensive, immersive training environment, in which students work in a machine shop 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 6 months. Second, nationally recognized credentials and certificates at the end of the program, so that the student's training is officially recognized and is transportable. Third, a realistic, on-the-job training environment, in which students produce real products on real machinery and thus can go to employers with real-world experience. And fourth, placement connections with local employers, of whom the region's fastest growing at the moment are in healthcare and logistics. Multi-point plans naturally sound platitudinous, but TET's approach resembles strategies we had seen work elsewhere. For instance, the one at East Mississippi Community College. By early 2015, nearly 400 local people had completed the full program at TET, Clark said, adding, "And we have put most of our graduates back to work in the high-tech manufacturing world. There are thousands of these high-tech jobs out there. We cannot train people fast enough for them." TET was designed for adults who have already run into problems with a modern working world. Meanwhile, Gallo, as president of the school board, Clark, and their allies were launching a parallel effort to prepare the city's school children to be ahead of the game. Bill Clark took me to see what this meant in practice at two public schools that would normally be classified as troubled or have not. As we drove up to Captain Leland Norton Elementary School, home of the Aviators, we passed three police cars on patrol. There and at nearby Indian Springs High School, home of the Coyotes, where a large team of security officers were biking around campus, virtually all students arrive with financial, educational, linguistic, or other family background challenges. It was at this same Indian Springs High School that Barack and Michelle Obama met families of the victims of the San Bernardino terrorist shootings in December 2015. These were the places where the San Bernardino school system made a commitment to training students for skilled technical jobs. Mike Gallo sent me a picture of a Norton third grader showing him the SolidWorks 3D design program. Gallo added in an email, "This is the exact same program my rocket scientists use to develop the latest rocket test systems for NASA's Space Shuttle Replacement Vehicle. This is the student engagement environment and culture of high expectations that our students are now able to experience. This will transform San Bernardino and provide them with the passport to prosperity." At Indian Springs High School, Clark showed me a fully outfitted machine tool workshop in which students are trained and then certified for highly skilled trades. Clark told me, "We've built our elementary school lab and middle school and high school so that students here will have a genuine pathway. By 2017, he said, all 17,000 students in all San Bernardino schools will leave one of our nine high schools with real-world credentials in a growth demand sector. These sectors, according to Clark, include healthcare and medical technology, strong in the region, logistics and transportation, ditto, and manufacturing. This model, giving all students a normal education, but also equipping them with technical skills, is one we've seen in action elsewhere and have come to respect." Can any of this happen? Are the odds too stiff? I don't know. By itself, will this solve San Bernardino's problems? Certainly not. But after spending time with people like these, and in their classrooms and with their students, I do know two things. One is that the school system is now moving forward rather than back. The other is that in a famously failed city with a long, struggling school system, people are working hard to give others a better chance.
Another high school in town, San Bernardino's Cajon High School, lies near the foot of the San Gabriel and San Bernardino Mountains and is the home of the Cowboys. The school graduates about 600 seniors each year. Some are bound for colleges from the Ivy League to the California state systems. Others will head to the military or to jobs in places like the local Target or the Stater Brothers supermarket. Cajon is a Title I school, which means it receives supplemental funds to help right the balance for its low-income and at-risk student population. After I spent a few days at Cajon in the spring, a mantra kept running through my mind. This school is changing lives, and sometimes even saving lives, one student at a time. A variety of programs help keep the students in school and graduating. CalSafe provides daycare on site for students with infants. Credit Recovery guides students to make up credits that have been lost somehow along the way. For some of the most troubled students, creative, holistic solutions are there, like the Ladies Club, which offers I Am Wonderful classes to help build self-esteem, an angel closet brimming with free clothing, and a Thanksgiving dinner served with turkey and trimmings of social graces. The promise of a pink sash draping the commencement robe awaits those who succeed. Some programs are run by the students themselves, best buddies, for students helping mentally disabled students. The Link Crew, for mentorships between upperclassmen and entering ninth graders. And University Prep Club, for older students who work with younger ones on college prep skills and calendars. The school also helps the students' entire families with the food bank, ESL classes for parents as well as students, and computer classes for adults. The California National Guard runs a cadet corps on campus. And then there is AVID. The acronym stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination, a nationwide program with specially trained teachers to get students ready for college. Get ready means inculcating the students, most of whom will be the first in their families to go to college, with a mindset that puts college on their radar and hones their skills both to get them to college and to be successful there. The AVID program is a two-way street. Students receive intense one-on-one attention from their AVID teacher, and as it turns out, from each other, and they commit to a complete package of reading, writing, talking, and thinking for their AVID classwork, as well as to taking some advanced-level high school courses, like AP courses. This rote description doesn't begin to do justice to what I saw in the AVID classes at Cajon High School and what I heard from the dozen or so students who talked with me. I learned about AVID from the program's teacher when I visited, Chris Peters, or Peters, as the students all seemed to call him. The most dramatic statements came from the students. They talked about their home lives and the value of finding a family with their AVID class. They were aware of their pioneering first-to-college places in their families, and they were brimming with ambition. Here, in their own words. Before this advisory period, I didn't know the importance of a support system. I was going to drop out, be on the street. In my home, there is selling drugs, alcoholism, all the drama. Something's wrong. I'm tired of being a peacemaker. We're like a family in class. We're more of a family. I never would have thought of it. I'll be the first to go to college. I want to change the pattern of the family to create a new era. The program pushes us to explore yourself, make something of yourself. I want to find a cure for cancer, or go into cardiology or neurology. I want to do neonatal nursing. My family wanted me to work at the local grocery store without anything more. I want to be a certified medical assistant. I want an MA in psychology. I want to be a counselor and a CPA. I want to do criminal psychology. At home, I hear, I will kill you. And they think that is pretty much okay. What makes people think that is okay? The cops come by our house all the time. I know I can do better. I will try so hard. I want to do social work. My dad did drugs. I want to get others out of that. I want to do police work. When the police come by, my family tries to cover for my uncles. I realize the police are there to protect people in the community. I was put there in my family for a reason. I'm not left off the hook. I want to do computer engineering. My parents came illegally to the U.S., they heard about the DREAM Act on the news, and a social worker helped us with the process. I have a permit to stay and study. I want to do criminal justice. And how do their lives look several years out once the students have gone on to chase those dreams? They pointed to the difficulty and importance of getting out of town. Some families drove them out of the house, some held them too close, and the lessons they learned. Money is a prominent obstacle. Lack of it first, then managing it if it comes their way. All the students, whether in real time or in hindsight, valued the personal attention from their teachers, like Peters, whose words replayed in their heads when they needed them. From a 2007 graduate, AVID was truly a blessing for me. I really cannot imagine where my life would have gone without this stable program and caring teachers to help direct me. I was able to get into a four-year university after graduation. I decided to attend Cal State University, Northridge, and ended up graduating with a bachelor's in sociology last May 2012. My parents were not very supportive with my decision to move over an hour away from home to attend college when Cal State San Bernardino was right next door. Because of this, I had to figure out a way to pay for college and living expenses on my own. In all honesty, I can say that it was not always easy, and I worked sometimes two or three jobs to support my choice of going away for school. But in the end, I got much more out of that experience. It made me stronger, wiser, independent, and proud of myself. Not only that, but nowadays my parents respect my decision. College was a great experience, yet extremely busy and tiring. From a 2008 graduate, upon graduating, I took the leap and decided to attend UC Santa Barbara. It was a tough decision. I was reluctant, not only because it was far away from home, but also because I knew I would be competing against people from privileged backgrounds. I figured these kids would be much better prepared than I, and that turned out to be true. However, this realization did not discourage me, and it should not discourage you. After holistically receiving the worst grades of my life during my first quarter at UCSB, I improved my GPA every single quarter subsequently and graduated with distinction honors as a history major in 2012. My time at UCSB also broadened my horizons and showed me that a kid from San Bernardino can make it just as far as the kid from the suburbs in Orange County. This mentality is what pushed me to apply to law school and take another shot at success. I just finished my first year at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Law school is tough, so if you ever think about applying, then don't take the decision lightly. I'm happy with my decision, and am currently clerking for the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. Jim and I sat down to pizza and beer with a half dozen millennials at a bar in San Bernardino. It was about 8 months before the infamous shootings took place in December 2015. About 2 years before that, the young people had assembled themselves into a loose organization motivated by anger they felt about the awful state of affairs in their hometown on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. I was pissed off, Michael Segura told us. By the time I was old enough to vote, everything was in such terrible shape in San Bernardino. They clearly loved their town and were ready to pick up and do something about it. The thinkers and dreamers, as they described themselves, were dreaming big. From early on, they said, "We are a movement, not an organization." They call themselves San Bernardino Generation Now, SBGN. In their efforts to educate, engage, and eventually empower a new generation of leaders, some of those in SBGN turned to their strength, art. Several of the members were artists. They knew what they could do themselves as artists, and they knew the people to network with in the San Bernardino art world. They could imagine a way through their art to the how of building civic engagement. Aiming ultimately to increase voter turnout, SBGN set out to educate by filming interviews with candidates about the issues that would be most interesting to young voters. They went into the high school government classes to talk about local government and voting. They invited candidates and government officials to community events that they built around music, food, and visual arts. They made themselves obvious and accessible to other young people around town, painting murals in battered-looking areas, rehabilitating parks, planting gardens, picking up trash, and generally keeping on the move. They were not only actors in their own good deeds, but models for others to copy. People started showing up and joining their efforts.
These young people of San Bernardino Generation Now, men and women, Latino and black and white, and Asian and multiracial in various combinations, some college-trained and some not, made a strong impression on us, probably because the challenge they took on was so immense. Their approach was initially artistic, but their goals were civic, cultural, and political. We asked the same question of them and about them that we had of the likes of Mike Gallo and Bill Clark. Why? Given all the obstacles in San Bernardino, why did young people like this bother, rather than simply moving someplace else? People with choices have often chosen just to leave environments like this one. Why did they soldier on? In addition to modeling the change and behavior they hope to see, two other themes came through the discussion. One was anger. Across the country, we saw negative self-image, stemming from being someplace that most people mocked as having powerful possibilities, both good and bad. The bad side is obvious. The good side is the "we'll show them" motivation that rang through efforts in the Golden Triangle and so many other places, including San Bernardino. The other was faith. Many of the people working to change this troubled town said that religion was part of their motivation. For better and worse, faith has always been one of the great non-rational motivators, along with family, nationalism, place-based loyalties, romantic love, and the like. But religious organizations are clearly a big factor in the effort to improve San Bernardino. For instance, a group called ICUC, Inland Congregations United for Change, and its director Tom Dolan have been inspirations for Generation Now. Among other lessons they conveyed was the non-obvious point that the group should not incorporate itself as a normal 501c3 nonprofit group. As a normal nonprofit, it could not engage directly in local politics, and changing the political complexion of the city is an important part of Generation Now's goal. San Bernardino is absolutely coming up, Jenica Billen said. But I hope it doesn't come up just in the usual way, with some other people moving in. We'd like to make it work with our own people. Riverside, California. A generation ago, the nearby cities of Riverside and San Bernardino might have seemed to have almost comparable prospects. Each was the namesake, county seat, and main commercial center of its county. They're barely a dozen miles apart, both built along the usually dry bed of the Santa Ana River, with scenic mountains all around. Both had expanded during California's long post-World War II boom, but also suffered the boom-related effects of sprawl development, congested traffic, water shortage, and especially smog. Each had a large nearby Air Force base, March in the canyonlands outside Riverside, Norton in a gravelly, dry stream bed within San Bernardino that was an important boost for the economy of the town. Riverside had started out on a different trajectory, with orange growing and tourism as the bases for its economy rather than the railroads, steelworks, and other blue-collar industries that were dominant in San Bernardino. Kevin Starr, the great chronicler of California history, and by chance a professor of mine in college when he was a 20-something graduate student, once called Riverside the classic citrus town of the West, and San Bernardino a classic transportation town. But through my childhood, in the 1950s and 1960s in the town of Redlands, which was much smaller than either of these cities, and located roughly a dozen miles from each of them, people spoke of San Bernardino and Riverside as parts of a natural pairing, rather than as stark contrasts. A major element in Riverside's modern story was the state's decision during the expansive governorship of Pat Brown in the late 1950s to convert what had been an agricultural experiment station into a full campus of the well-respected University of California system. That has become the core of a major higher education complex in Riverside, one that brings some 40,000 students and tens of thousands of faculty members and support staffers to town. San Bernardino has a community college and a branch of the Cal State system, but not a comparable research university. When the two towns were on an even footing, the big federal legal center was in downtown San Bernardino. In the 1970s, Riverside attracted the U.S. attorney's offices, several federal courthouses,